Chapter 67. Mohun appears for the last time in this history. Besides my Lord Duke of Hamilton and Brandon, who for family reasons had kindly promised his protection and patronage to Colonel Esmond, he had other great friends in power now, both able and willing to assist him, and he might, with such allies, look forward to as fortunate advancement in civil life at home as he had got rapid promotion abroad. His Grace was magnanimous enough to offer to take Mr. Esmond as secretary on his Paris embassy, but no doubt he intended that proposal should be rejected. At any rate, Esmond could not bear the thoughts of attending his mistress farther than the church door after her marriage, and so declined that offer which his generous rival made him. Other gentlemen in power were liberal at least of compliments and promises to Colonel Esmond. Mr. Harley, now become my Lord Oxford and Mortimer, and installed Knight of the Garter on the same day as His Grace of Hamilton had received the same honor, sent to the Colonel to say that a seat in Parliament should be at his disposal presently, and Mr. St. John held out many flattering hopes of advancement to the Colonel when he should enter the House. Esmond's friends were all successful, and the most successful and triumphant of all was his dear old commander, General Webb, who was now appointed Lieutenant General of the Land Forces, and received with particular honor by the ministry, by the Queen, and the people out of doors, who huzzaed the brave chief when they used to see him in his chariot going to the House, or to the drawing room, or hobbling on foot to his coach from St. Stephen's upon his glorious old crutch and stick, and cheered him as loud as they had ever done Marlborough. That great duke was utterly disgraced, and honest old Webb dated all his Grace's misfortunes from Winendal, and vowed that fate served the traitor right. Duchess Sarah had also gone to ruin. She had been forced to give up her keys, and her places, and her pensions. Says Webb, she would have locked up 3 millions of French crowns with her keys, had I but been knocked on the head, but I stopped that convoy at Winendal. Our enemy Cardonnel was turned out of the House of Commons along with Mr. Walpole, for malversation of public money. Cadogan lost his place of Lieutenant of the Tower. Marlborough's daughters resigned their posts of ladies of the bedchamber, and so complete was the Duke's disgrace, that his son-in-law, Lord Bridgewater, was absolutely obliged to give up his lodgings at St. James, and had his half-pension, as Master of the Horse, taken away. But I think the lowest depth of Marlborough's fall was when he humbly sent to ask General Webb when he might wait upon him. He who had commanded the stout old general, who had injured him, and sneered at him, who had kept him dangling in his antechamber, who could not even after his great service condescend to write him a letter in his own hand. The nation was as eager for peace as ever it had been hot for war. The Prince of Savoy came amongst us, had his audience of the Queen, and got his famous sword of honor, and strove with all his force to form a Whig party together, to bring over the young Prince of Hanover, to do anything which might prolong the war, and consummate the ruin of the old sovereign whom he hated so implacably. But the nation was tired of the struggle, so completely wearied of it, that not even our defeat at Denain could rouse us into any anger, though such an action, so lost 2 years before, would have set all England in a fury. 'Twas easy to see that the great Marlborough was not with the army. Eugene was obliged to fall back in a rage, and forego the dazzling revenge of his life. 'Twas in vain the Duke's side asked, would we suffer our arms to be insulted? Would we not send back the only champion who could repair our honor? The nation had had its bellyful of fighting, nor could taunts or outcries goad up our Britons any more. For a statesman that was always prating of liberty, and had the grandest philosophic maxims in his mouth, it must be owned that Mr. St. John sometimes rather acted like a Turkish than a Greek philosopher, and especially fell foul of one unfortunate set of men, the men of letters, with a tyranny a little extraordinary in a man who professed to respect their calling so much. The literary controversy at this time was very bitter. The government side was the winning one, the popular one, and I think might have been the merciful one. 'Twas natural that the opposition should be peevish and cry out. Some men did so from their hearts, admiring the Duke of Marlborough's prodigious talents, and deploring the disgrace of the greatest general the world ever knew. 'Twas the stomach that caused other patriots to grumble, and such men cried out, because they were poor, and paid to do so. Against these my Lord Bolingbroke never showed the slightest mercy, whipping a dozen in two prisoner into the pillory without the least commiseration. From having been a man of arms, Mr. Esmond had now come to be a man of letters, but on a safer side than that in which the above-cited poor fellows ventured their liberties and ears. There was no danger on ours, which was the winning side. Besides, Mr. Esmond pleased himself by thinking that he writ like a gentleman, if he did not always succeed as a wit. Of the famous wits of that age, who have rendered Queen Anne's reign illustrious, and whose works will be in all Englishmen's hands in ages yet to come, Mr. Esmond saw many, but at public places chiefly, never having a great intimacy with any of them, except with honest Dick Steele and Mr. Addison, who parted company with Esmond, however, when that gentleman became a declared Tory, and lived on close terms with the leading persons of that party. Addison kept himself to a few friends, and very rarely opened himself except in their company. A man more upright and conscientious than he it was not possible to find in public life, and one whose conversation was so various, easy, and delightful. Writing now in my mature years, I own that I think Addison's politics were the right, and were my time to come over again, I would be a Whig in England, and not a Tory. But with people that take a side in politics, 'tis men rather than principles that commonly bind them. A kindness or a slight puts a man under one flag or the other, and he marches with it to the end of the campaign. Esmond's master in war was injured by Marlborough, and hated him. And the lieutenant fought the quarrels of his leader. Webb coming to London, was used as a weapon by Marlborough's enemies, and true steel he was, that honest chief, nor was his aide-de-camp, Mr. Esmond, an unfaithful or unworthy partisan. 'Tis strange here, and on a foreign soil, and in a land that is independent in all but the name, for that the North American colonies shall remain dependents on yonder little island for 20 years more, I never can think. To remember how the nation at home seemed to give itself up to the domination of one or other aristocratic party, and took a Hanoverian king, or a French one, according as either prevailed. And while the Tories, the October Club gentlemen, the high church parsons, that held by the Church of England, were for having a papist king, for whom many of their Scottish and English leaders, firm churchmen all, laid down their lives with admirable loyalty and devotion, they were governed by men who had notoriously no religion at all, but used it as they would use any opinion for the purpose of forwarding their own ambition. The Whigs, on the other hand, who professed attachment to religion and liberty too, were compelled to send to Holland or Hanover for a monarch around whom they could rally. A strange series of compromises is that English history, compromise of principle, compromise of party, compromise of worship. The lovers of English freedom and independence submitted their religious consciences to an act of Parliament. Could not consolidate their liberty without sending to Zell or the Hague for a king to live under, and could not find amongst the proudest people in the world a man speaking their own language, and understanding their laws, to govern them. The Tory and High Church patriots were ready to die in defense of a papist family that had sold us to France. The great Whig nobles, the sturdy Republican recusants who had cut off Charles Stuart's head for treason, were fain to accept a king whose title came to him through a royal grandmother, whose own royal grandmother's head had fallen under Queen Bess's hatchet. And our proud English nobles sent to a petty German town for a monarch to come and reign in London, and our prelates kissed the ugly hands of his Dutch mistresses, and thought it no dishonor. In England you can but belong to one party or t'other, and you take the house you live in with all its encumbrances, its retainers, its antique discomforts, and ruins even. You patch up, But you never build up anew. Will we of the New World submit much longer, even nominally, to this ancient British superstition? There are signs of the times which make me think that ere long we shall care as little about King George here, and peers temporal and peers spiritual, as we do for King Canute or the Druids. This chapter began about the wits, my grandson may say, and hath wandered very far from their company. The pleasantest of the wits I knew were the doctors Garth and Arbuthnot, and Mr. Gay, the author of Rivia, the most charming kind soul that ever laughed at a joke, or cracked a bottle. Mr. Pryor I saw, and he was the earthen pot swimming with the pots of brass down the stream, and always and justly frightened lest he should break in the voyage. I met him both at London and Paris, where he was performing piteous congees to the Duke of Shrewsbury, not having courage to support the dignity which his undeniable genius and talent had won him, and writing coaxing letters to Secretary St. John, and thinking about his plate and his place, and what on earth should become of him should his party go out. The famous Mr. Congreve I saw a dozen of times at Button's, a splendid wreck of a man, magnificently attired, and though gouty, and almost blind, bearing a brave face against fortune. The great Mr. Pope, of whose prodigious genius I have no words to express my admiration, was quite a puny lad at this time, appearing seldom in public places. There were hundreds of men, wits, and pretty fellows frequenting the theaters and coffee houses of that day whom Unc Perscribere longum est. Indeed, I think the most brilliant of that sort I ever saw was not till 15 years afterwards, when I paid my last visit in England, and met young Harry Fielding, son of the Fielding that served in Spain and afterwards in Flanders with us, and who for fun and humor seemed to top them all. As for the famous Dr. Swift, I can say of him, vitae tantum. He was in London all these years up to the death of the Queen, and in 100 public places where I saw him, but no more. He never missed court of a Sunday, where once or twice he was pointed out to your grandfather. He would have sought me out eagerly enough had I been a great man with a title to my name, or a star on my coat. At court the doctor had no eyes, but for the very greatest. Lord Treasurer and St. John used to call him Jonathan, and they paid him with this cheap coin for the service they took of him. He writ their lampoons, fought their enemies, flogged and bullied in their service, and it must be owned with a consummate skill and fierceness. 'Tis said he hath lost his intellect now, and forgotten his wrongs and his rage against mankind. I have always thought of him, and of Marlborough as the two greatest men of that age. I have read his books, who doth not know them? Here in our calm woods, and imagine a giant to myself as I think of him, a lonely fallen Prometheus, groaning as the vulture tears him. Prometheus I saw, but when first I ever had any words with him, the giant stepped out of a sedan chair in the Poultry, whither he had come with a tipsy Irish servant parading before him, who announced him, bawling out his reverence's name, whilst his master below was as yet haggling with the chairman. I disliked this Mr. Swift, and heard many a story about him, of his conduct to men, and his words to women. He could flatter the great as much as he could bully the weak, and Mr. Esmond, being younger and hotter in that day than now, was determined, should he ever meet this dragon, not to run away from his teeth and his fire. Men have all sorts of motives which carry them onwards in life, and are driven into acts of desperation, or it may be of distinction, from 100 different causes. There was one comrade of Esmond's, an honest little Irish lieutenant of Handysides, who owed so much money to a camp soodler that he began to make love to the man's daughter, intending to pay his debt that way, and at the Battle of Malplaquet, flying away from the dead and lady too, he rushed so desperately on the French lines that he got his company, and came a captain out of the action, and had to marry the soodler's daughter after all, who brought him his cancelled debt to her father as poor Roger's fortune. To run out of the reach of bill and marriage, he ran on the enemy's pikes, and as these did not kill him, he was thrown back upon t'other horn of his dilemma. Our great duke at the same battle was fighting, not the French, but the Tories in England, and risking his life and the armies, not for his country, but for his pay and places, and for fear of his wife at home, that only being in life whom he dreaded. I have asked about men in my own company. New drafts of poor country boys were perpetually coming over to us during the wars, and brought from the ploughshare to the sword, and found that a half of them under the flags were driven thither on account of a woman. One fellow was jilted by his mistress, and took the shilling in despair. Another jilted the girl, and fled from her, and the parish to the tents, where the law could not disturb him. Why go on particularizing? What can the sons of Adam and Eve expect, but to continue in that course of love, and trouble their father and mother set out on? Oh, my grandson! I am drawing nigh to the end of that period of my history, when I was acquainted with the great world of England and Europe. My years are past the Hebrew poet's limit, and I say unto thee, all my troubles and joys too, for that matter, have come from a woman, as thine will when thy destined course begins. 'Twas a woman that made a soldier of me, that set me intriguing afterwards. I believe I would have spun smocks for her had she so bidden me. What strength I had in my head I would have given her. Hath not every man in his degree had his Omphale and Delilah? Mine befooled me on the banks of the Thames, and in dear old England, thou mayest find thine own by Rappahannock. To please that woman then I tried to distinguish myself as a soldier, and afterwards as a wit and a politician. As to please another I would have put on a black cassock and a pair of pants, and had done so, but that a superior fate intervened to defeat that project. And I say, I think the world is like Captain Esmond's company I spoke of anon. And could you see every man's career in life, you would find a woman clogging him, or clinging round his march and stopping him, or cheering him and goading him, or beckoning him out of her chariot, so that he goes up to her, and leaves the race, to be run without him, or bringing him the apple, and saying at, or fetching him the daggers and whispering ill. Yonder lies Duncan, and a crown, and an opportunity. Your grandfather fought with more effect as a politician than as a wit. And having private animosities and grievances of his own, and his generals against the great duke in command of the army, and more information on military matters than most writers, who had never seen beyond the fire of a tobacco pipe at Hills, he was enabled to do good service for that cause which he embarked in, and for Mr. St. John and his party. But he disdained the abuse in which some of the Tory writers indulged. For instance, Dr. Swift, who actually chose to doubt the Duke of Marlborough's courage, and was pleased to hint that his Grace's military capacity was doubtful. Nor were Esmond's performances worse for the effect they were intended to produce, though no doubt they could not injure the Duke of Marlborough nearly so much in the public eyes as the malignant attacks of Swift did, which were carefully directed so as to blacken and degrade him, because they were writ openly and fairly by Mr. Esmond, who made no disguise of them, who was now out of the army, and who never attacked the prodigious courage and talents, only the selfishness and rapacity, of the chief. The colonel then, having writ a paper for one of the Tory journals, called the postboy, a letter upon bow chain, that the town talked about for 2 whole days, when the appearance of an Italian singer supplied a fresh subject for conversation. And having business at the exchange, where Mistress Beatrix wanted a pair of gloves or a fan very likely, Esmond went to correct his paper, and was sitting at the printer's, when the famous Dr. Swift came in, his Irish fellow with him that used to walk before his chair, and bawled out his master's name with great dignity. Mr. Esmond was waiting for the printer too, whose wife had gone to the tavern to fetch him, and was meantime engaged in drawing a picture of a soldier on horseback for a dirty little pretty boy of the printer's wife, whom he had left behind her. "I presume you are the editor of the Postboy, sir?" says the doctor, in a grating voice that had an Irish twang, and he looked at the colonel from under his 2 bushy eyebrows with a pair of very clear blue eyes. His complexion was muddy, his figure rather fat, his chin double. He wore a shabby cassock, and a shabby hat over his black wig, and he pulled out a great gold watch, at which Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.